I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a medical checkup this hour on the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, 1 year after it kicked in. Our guest, Steve Brill, has written the book that people are talking about, America's Bitter Pill, about a care system that was, practically speaking, re-architected by four powerful sectors of the health industry. Hospitals, drug companies, the instrument folk who make MRI machines and pacemakers, and of course the doctors. It's a $3+ trillion system, far the biggest industry in this country, with 10 million previously uninsured people newly enrolled and more on the way into a stupendously expensive culture of care. Americans spend more on back pain than on all the police forces in state, city, and town uniforms combined. Medtronic, in Minneapolis, maker of thousands of medical devices, reports double the gross profits of Apple. The quotable CEO of Intel, Craig Barrett, observes that the U.S. increases its healthcare costs by one Iraq war per year. Steve Brill, in his book, will make your head spin with all the money interests underlying Obamacare. And still, there are human beings in this picture, and you'll hear them this hour from doctors committed to close-up care and also to viral innovations in delivery and prevention. The journalist Steve Brill gets us started. The point of his long, bitter pill is that the way Obamacare works, what you like or don't like about it, all comes out of the way it was made.
I saw the book as a way to demonstrate with a narrative style, with all the whole roller coaster ups and downs, what happens in this country when what has become a dysfunctional, money-driven government attempts to fix or reform a dysfunctional part of our economy, which in fact is 1/6 of our economy, in fact is arguably the most important consumer product we all buy, which is healthcare, and in fact is an economy the size of France. So what happens when a government that has been overrun by lobbyists tries to do something called reform of the healthcare system? And what happens is that all the healthcare interests that are hiring all those lobbyists end up doing better than before you had reform. That's the bad news. The prices are still way too high. That's the bad news. The good news is that 10 to 20 million more Americans now have access to healthcare, which is fast erasing what has been a long time national disgrace, which is that among the developed countries in the world, we're the only one of them that hasn't done something to make sure most, if not all, of our citizens have access to health care.
So the 10 million, the new ones, you could say, have been fed into a system that absolutely nobody can afford.
No one can afford it, and nobody understands. And the only people who can afford it are the ones who are riding the gravy train, and that doesn't include the doctors and the nurses who actually provide the care. It includes executives at medical device makers. It includes CAT scan salesmen. It includes hospital CEOs who typically make millions of dollars a year and always make more than the president of the university that they're associated with, which is
or the doctors and nurses that are actually way more than holding the patients.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, our country, our system is so upside down that there are twice as many people working in the health insurance industry, processing paper and sending out bills, than there are doctors providing care.
We're also remembering that in Boston, we're talking about our proudest, oldest industry, still huge glory to this town. But we're mystified by the questions that don't come up in this kind of presentation of a plan.
Well, let's talk about Boston. I mean, you say oldest, proudest industry, which is healthcare, Mass General, Brigham and Women's. There's another big industry related to healthcare in Massachusetts, and that's the medical device industry. Now, the medical device industry is one of the most profitable industries. Their profit margins are through the roof. The leading medical device maker, Medtronic, has much higher profit margins even than Apple. So part of the Obamacare law that made some sense was they put a tax of 3%, an excise tax of 3% on all medical devices, all durable medical equipment, as they call it. Now, that was the rationale was, well, we're about to give the people who make pacemakers and artificial hips and artificial knees and neurostimulators for your back that nobody really needs, but everybody gets. We're about to give them tens of millions of new customers. Let's get a little bit of a tax on them. It's a excise tax, which means it's not just on, you know, domestic companies, it's on foreign companies. And the industry howled. They said, this is a jobs killer. This is a profit killer. It's terrible. And it wasn't just the Republicans. In Washington, when it comes to healthcare lobbying, it is bipartisan. The sainted Elizabeth Warren is trying to get that tax repealed. Right. Al Franken is trying to get that tax repealed, as well as the Republicans. It's the one sort of bipartisan thing going on Capitol Hill is let's repeal the medical device tax because their tentacles are so deep on Capitol Hill. Now, is it a jobs killer? Is it a profits killer? Well, let's look at Medtronic. Since Obamacare was signed, Medtronic's profit is up 67%, and it's added more than 5,000 people to the payroll. Doesn't sound like a jobs killer. Doesn't sound like a profits killer. And it stands logic on its head. If you suddenly create all these new people who have health insurance who can buy artificial hips and knees and buy pacemakers and buy stents and do all this other stuff that give companies like Medtronic so much profit, or Boston Scientific,
I was going to
so
say, Boston profit, Scientific is probably not far behind.
You know, Obamacare is a gravy train for these companies. And the idea that 3% tax has hurt them is just hilarious. There's just no evidence of it.
Boston is also the home of Romney Care, which was the father of Obamacare, and the child, in a way, of Dukakis and other efforts at universal health care in Massachusetts. But question, why is it so hard, even here, but certainly at the national level, to even question the role of private insurance?
Well, the reason is that the politics of that are just impossibly unrealistic. If we could roll the clock back to 1943, we could do it. In 1943, a little-known a government agency called the War Labor Board, which President Roosevelt charged with making sure that price controls and wage controls were enforced during World War II, met, and they had a problem. A lot of employers were starting to try to get around the freeze on wages by offering their employees health insurance because health costs were starting to become relevant. There were some drugs like penicillin. There were now ways to treat the sick. So people were starting to spend, you know, 5-6% of the GDP on health care. So these employers said, well, you know, here's a great way around the freeze on wages. We'll lure workers and we'll keep workers by giving them health insurance. So the War Labor Board met and had to consider whether that would count as a wage increase. And in a decision where I have yet to find a news clip anywhere, they decided it's not a wage increase. They can do it. And there was a flood of health insurance bought by employers for their employees. That started the private health insurance industry in the United States, where it pretty much doesn't exist almost anywhere else.
It comes up all the time now that there's no very, very good reason to attach insurance to a particular company or even to an employer or even to employment.
And by the way,
why is it so hard, though, to detach it?
Because employers like it, you know, executives like it because it's tax-free income and their income tax rates at high levels of earnings are high. What I explain in the book is how we have become, healthcare has become an alternate economic universe where everything's different. You know, a lot of us actually heard something about a recession, you know, the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. The healthcare industry never got that memo. They had no recession. Drug company CEOs, hospital CEOs, their incomes just kept going up. Hospital CEOs' incomes have averaged an increase of 22% in the last 2 years, and doctors' incomes have averaged an increase of 1%. Just think about that.
You write, Steve Brill, at the very end of this fascinating book that we have now, with the Affordable Care Act, in effect, paid a huge money ransom to the industry. But the hope at the end of the book is that we can now force, through the sticker shock of all these prices, force the industry to get some cost reductions.
Right. And in fact, when Romney Care was passed here in Massachusetts, and I should hasten to say that Obamacare is a slightly more conservative Republican version of Romney Care. Obamacare really mirrors a bunch of proposals Richard Nixon made in the 70s to head off Ted Kennedy's more liberal proposals. That's what Obamacare is. The people involved who I interviewed for the book were very candid about this, and they were candid at the time. They said, well, we can, you know, there are two problems with healthcare in the United States. People, you know, more people need coverage. They don't have coverage. And the costs are just obscene. And what they decided was, well, the politics of dealing with costs, even in Massachusetts, are impossible. We're not going to be able to deal with costs. But let's go get coverage. So we'll get people coverage, and then we'll deal with costs later. And in fact, when more people have coverage, the costs will be so high and so glaring that there'll be a crisis, and we'll have to do something about costs.
That's the sticker shock part.
And the first part worked out. They got the coverage. They're still working on the second part.
Steve Brill, I want to go very, very big picture on all of this and about the country itself, this country we barely understand. But I'm thinking in 500 years from now, if there is such a thing, people will look at 21st century America. I think they will wonder what other country in history facing the universal, endless fear of illness and of death, the great equalizer, what other country could afford to throw trillions and trillions of dollars at it and not bat an eye, which is what we're doing.
Democracies generally, this one in particular, this one especially once money really takes over the way it has, you know, our election redistricting process, our lobbying process. The problem with healthcare is it's one explanation of benefits and one bill at a time, and it's this slow motion crisis. You know, 2 years ago, we thought it was a disaster that $2.6 trillion was being spent on healthcare in the United States. This year, it's going to be $3.2 trillion. You know, that's a lot of money, but there's no precipitating event. And you know, America often needs a crisis to do something.
That was the Omni reporter Stephen Brill, writer, editor, publisher, and teacher at Yale of independent journalism. His book is America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Coming up, two of the star primary care docs at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Rushika Fernando-Poulet and John Goodson, at two different frontiers of reform. This is Open Source. Here is Howard Dean, the medical doctor, one-time governor of Vermont, and candidate for president in 2004, who said he spoke for the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And he continued to play that part through the healthcare debate. Howard Dean still says that Obama and Hillary Clinton both have private insurance doing what Medicare could do better, and they also retain a fee-for-service billing system that runs up costs item by item. I asked Howard Dean how he would attack the cost monster.
Basically, a system that pays us by the patient and not by the procedure that we do to the patient is a wellness system. Because now, and this is what a Kaiser is an example, there are other examples. The Cleveland Clinic is an outstanding example of this. Now, you get paid to keep the patient out of the hospital. Today, you want to fill all those ICU beds. Because that's where you – intensive care beds, because that's where you make a lot of money. And you want to fill your cardiac catheterization labs, because that's where you make a lot of money. But in the new world that I believe we could be headed for under with the president's bill, if the private sector chooses to do this, and there are a lot of people who don't want healthcare costs to go up, so there is going to be some pressure to change this. In the new world, you get paid to keep people out of the ICU and keep them out of the hospital. And that means you've got to take care of 21-year-olds with diabetes who have weight problems and so forth. And you've got to make some real investment and effort up front. So we finally have a system that encourages and rewards financially wellness instead of illness. And I think that's a system that a lot of Americans have wanted for a long time.
That was the doctor politician Howard Dean of Vermont. Our guests in the studio are at different forefronts in the healthcare reform movement. Dr. Rushika Fernando-Poulet runs a broad network of experiments in the delivery of medicine at Iora Health. He's also still a staff doctor at MGH. Dr. John Goodson has been practicing internal medicine through long days at MGH for 40 years now, and he's been a change agent all the way. Dr. Fernando-Poulet, we know you, it's wonderful to meet you, but we know you for years through Atul Gawande in the pages of The New Yorker. You're the model of the experimentalist at work reforming the system from inside. What are you up to specifically in this matter of cutting costs? The access and the inclusion problems have in some sense been solved, but there's that huge cost monster, we say, that hasn't been tackled. What are you doing?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to note that I think what you should never do is try to address healthcare costs, because it's actually too easy to do that. And we've seen that we've seen this movie in the 1980s, just stop doing things to people. And in the short run, you can save healthcare costs, right? Just don't give them healthcare and find ways to make it hard for people to access the system. That was the playbook of managed care in the 1980s. But we've seen that movie, it ends up really poorly. So the real way to do it is, how do we actually fix how we deliver care? And because we know that 30 to 50% of what we do in this country is waste for healthcare, that will lower healthcare costs. It's really important to get that right. Do the right thing for patients. Do the right thing in terms of care delivery. That will save costs. So that's what we're aimed at. How do we actually deliver care the right way? And I think what a lot of people are doing, I think Obamacare really took on, as you said, the access issue, but didn't really take on head on how we deliver care. I think politically it was too difficult to take those on for all the reasons that Mr. Brill pointed out. And we said, let's actually try and actually fix the delivery system in two different ways. One is, instead of going top down, which is what a lot of people are trying to do, start with big health systems and so hope it trickles down. Let's start with where people actually get most of their care, where they should get most of their care, which is primary care, right? This is a place where we can actually help people make decisions, manage their health, and navigate the whole health system. Let's start
the old
with
GP,
care.
The internal medicine guy who knows your whole system, and you.
Absolutely, and help you make the right choices. As opposed to, unfortunately, the model of medicine in this country too often is that you have a cardiologist managing your hypertension, a pulmonologist managing your asthma, an endocrinologist managing your diabetes, and they never talk to each other. And they maybe send letters back and forth, and it's an unholy mess, right? It's not good for the patient. It's not good for the system. So really, let's start with primary care. We can manage 80 to 90% of this and use the specialists as consultants to help us out, right? So that's point one.
You've written a wonderful example of getting diabetic patients into the right zone. You call it a perfect space. Just give us that parable of the problem and a solution.
Yeah, I mean, so the point of primary care, I think, unfortunately, the way the primary care system is set up now is too often we've been squeezing primary care into a smaller and smaller box. Primary care is about 4 or 5% of healthcare spending in this country. That means that 96% of what we're spending is what I'd call failure of primary care. That's a really stupid investment philosophy. So one of our theories is, let's try and remake primary care. Let's build it from the ground up, and let's actually put the right amount of resources into it and rethink the model. So the current model, too often primary care doctors are stuck in a system where you're seeing 35 patients a day. You have 7 to 8 minutes per patient. So someone who's diabetic walks into you. You see them 3 or 4 times a year. The best you can do is look at their medicines, look at their huge chart and say, buddy, you should exercise more, eat better, take your medicine, good luck, I'll see you in 3 months, right? That's completely a dumb way to manage it, right? What we do instead is say, let's wrap a whole team around this patient, right? Let's actually make a what we call a shared care plan. We make a plan of what you can do, give you a personal health coach who speaks your language from your community, who can help you make that plan and execute on it, teach you about the disease, have you go to what we call diabetes clubs, where you meet other people who've got diabetes and can learn from them how to live with it, have you track it, have your glucometer upload to us, and we know if you're doing well or not doing well, and really sort of hold your hand when that's the right thing to do, and to be honest, kick you in the behind a little bit when that's the right thing to do. And when you do that, you can have a much better chance in an integrated way of actually helping people manage their diabetes.
What does it do to costs? Not that that's the ultimate, but serious.
Yes, what we see in our, so we build new practices from scratch with this sort of a model. We changed everything. We changed the payment model. As I said, as Governor Dean said, fee-for-service is the wrong way to pay for primary care. What it does is it makes you think of people as widgets off the line. The right way to think of it is, I have a population of people, they are my responsibility. The way to pay for that is, give me a fixed fee, let me decide how to take care of people, whether it's an email, a phone call, a diabetes club, a health coach, right, fixed fee. Number two is, change completely the process of how people deal with it, and then, you know, change the culture as well. And that's what we do, actually, for patients.
Dr. John Goodson, you like the primary care talk, the internal medicine talk too, at the heart of the profession. How do you practice it, and where are you taking it in the reform direction?
Well, you know, I'm a primary care physician, and I understand entirely the whole basis of the model that Hrishika has put together. My interest is broader, honestly, because my focus is to try to create ways to expand and support our primary care workforce so it'll do what it's supposed to do. You know, I think people 20, 30 years ago never imagined the possibility that we would have an insufficient number of people who did generalist medicine, either primary care internists or family medicine physicians. But there were a lot of decisions that were made at the initiation of the current era 25 years ago that had an unintended consequence. And so as a result, the very primary care workforce that Hrishika celebrates is withering and dying. And so we must make an intervention here if we're going to have even the opportunity to do the sorts of things that Dr. Fernandopoul talks about.
I got to ask you, how is it that you love it so much, night and day with patients of all kinds, and it's still been considered or classified as an unfashionable part of the profession?
Well, you know, I think that medicine is a very intimate experience, all about patient care. It's all about the interactivity that one has with people. Again, when you talk about trying to manage a patient with chronic disease, it really is getting them to understand the condition that they have and motivating them to change. Mm. But that's what rewards everybody in patient care, everybody who's a secretary, a nurse, a doctor, a consultant. I think we all live on those interactions. But what makes primary care unique is the continuous continuity relationship. It's building connectivity over time. And the economic argument for primary care is that that allows the development of trust. What is trust? What makes trust? It's a very interesting question, worthy of a show indeed, Chris. But at the end of the day, trust allows a clinician to use time as a diagnostic tool and a therapeutic intervention. I love my consultant colleagues. I adore the people I work with. I was on the phone several times today with people who are skilled in various areas. I love the ability to interact with that level of content expertise. But what I really want to do for my patients is to connect with them and work with them and utilize the expertise and talents that we have. One thing I'll say about what Mr. Brill said, you know, we live in a weird world. Healthcare is its own crazy economic system. But it is what it is, and we are not about to change that. Those who advocate single-payer models do not know what they're talking about. Medicare is a single-payer model, and as a system of healthcare delivery, it's got profound flaws. So we need to start working back to the beginning of the problem, which is the way that physicians are compensated for the work that they deliver. And until we achieve a balance in compensation, a parity in compensation between those who are proceduralists and those who practice the art of primary care, then we're just not going to have the system we want.
John Christian, I want you to go back one sec. You said something that struck me as it should be inscribed in my head or in the wall or something, but using time as something and as an intervention in itself.
Time can only be used as a diagnostic intervention and as a therapeutic tool if there's trust. If you trust that our communication will not end when we stop this conversation, that I will continue to worry about you and think about you. I have, you know, probably 1,100 patients in my village, and the village is scattered all over the planet, literally. Every single one of those people is within one instant of my consciousness. That's what I do. That's what we all do. That's the paradigm of primary care, the paradigm of my father, my grandfather. We've been in this business for over 100 years. And I can tell you there's really no difference between what I do and what my father did and what my grandfather did.
This is very touching, John. This is serious stuff. It sounds like Proust. Time as a therapeutic intervention and a diagnostic tool. That's deep. And we're going to get to that trust radio show too. But there's a mystery here. My family, my wife, children, have had the same primary care doctor for more than 40 years. I think we all think of it as one of the great privileges of our life. Who wouldn't love it? He knows all of us. He knows our connections. how in the world did we let this slip away? Fernando Poulet, I mean, or John.
Yeah, so I think John's exactly right, that the power of primary care, maybe the power of medicine, is about relationships. And that's been that way for 100 years. What we've done is we've turned healthcare in this country into a series of transactions. And forces have turned everything. So every time I do something in a typical system, I have to value it. I bill a 99213 or 99214. There are arcane rules. I've got to follow meaningful use and medical home and all these criteria. We've pushed aside the relationship trying to put these transactions in place. And I think until we get rid of that, and by the way, Medicare, I completed with John that single payer doesn't solve that. Medicare is a single payer, and they are probably the worst offender in the transactionalizing of medicine. But so what we need to do is, what we've been trying to do is take those away, get the relationship back, and that's what actually causes healing.
But John is also saying that it has something to do with dollars and cents and the compensation for different kinds of docs.
It's even worse. We've turned into transactions, but then we value those transactions differently. And a transaction of spending, you know, half an hour with the patient trying to figure out what the real issue is valued, for reasons he can explain much better than I can, much less than spending the same amount of time sticking needles or scalpels in people, whether they need it or not.
But what is your take, Dr. Fernando Poulet, on why the generalist, the primary care guy, has dwindled? Is it because of the money? Do you enjoy it as a thing to go and do every day or what?
You know, I still practice. I love practicing. I love practicing in the right environment. I think the problem is see numbers of people going into primary care going down. Why is that? Part of it's the money. A primary care doc doing the same amount of work gets paid literally half of what a specialist would do. And when people come out of medical school with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, that's a really hard trade-off to make. But number two is, in most primary care settings, the job sucks. You almost need your head examined to go work in a typical primary care setting where you've got 7-minute visits, all these people beating on you, and you feel like you're at the bottom end of the pyramid.
The working atmosphere, as they say in great majorities, is chaos.
I think the workforce is dispirited because they've been undervalued, and I think they've been underappreciated. But I think we need to do something. I mean, I don't think that we're not going to fix this until we get to work. And so that means that people like myself who feel that there's a way to fix this can sit idly at the side. I mean, Rashika's experimenting with models. There are other people that are experimenting with models. We need to offer hope. We need to offer hope to ourselves, to our primary care workforce. But there's some very discrete steps we have to take. One of them is to achieve compensation parity. We can no longer expect a primary care internist or family medicine doc to make half or even a third of what an ophthalmologist makes.
But who decided that in the first place?
This is the result of the way the economic system was established in 1992. So, as Rashika says, everything that's done in medicine has a value. It's a crazy world of RVUs. RVUs are turned into dollars every year by Medicare. This year, an RVU is worth $35.80 for 2015.
And remind me, what does RVU stand for?
Relative Value Unit. But you look at a surgeon, a cardiothoracic surgeon, can earn in one procedure more than I earn in an entire week. So how did that come to be? Well, it has to be with the way the services are evaluated. And the valuation process has been heavily dominated by the AMA through a process called the RUC, the Relative Value Update Committee. Over the last 25 years, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has basically accepted every single recommendation that they've made 9 out of 10 times. If you look at the composition of this body, it is 75% proceduralist. It is exactly the very people who are benefiting from the system.
I want to change the subject a little bit. The question is why Medicare for All just died again in Vermont. And just illustrating also the point that everything's related to everything. When you look into it, what you discover in the politics of that change, the governor said, we're going to get it. We're going to do one state, single payer for Vermont. He lost, basically, as I dope it out, that because the costs are still so high that for the state to cover all of them, they would have to have a big tax increase. Tax increases don't go. So we've got to stop right there. Bring us right back to the question of cost and getting the fundamental now, heading to $3.5 trillion bill reduced. Where do we go with that, John Goodson? Practical steps to get the cost down, so, and then do the other things.
So it's a weird economy because it's not a free economy. You know, a free economy depends on a consumer that doesn't have to buy and a vendor who doesn't have to sell. And so there can be a fair relationship. Mm. But now we have vendors who have proprietary products and consumers who are desperate to buy them. So first step, this system is craziness to begin with. Secondly, there are no inhibitions to price setting. And so things are priced at extreme levels without any kind of regulation.
So we're talking about costs. We're also talking about who pays, who delivers, experiments, best practices, on the anniversary, so to speak, and still another testing point for what's known as Obamacare. Coming up, a sample of what people on the street know and don't know about affordable care, and then more on this matter of what the country actually can afford. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the Affordable Care Hour with the doctors, John Goodson and Rushika Fernandopoulet. But first, what the people say when we ask them in Boston this week, what's missing in American healthcare?
Obamacare is probably working. It is probably the right thing to do for taking care of people.
I think he has to do a better job of selling it and really talk about it and explain it. I think people are confused.
It's just so confusing and no one really understands who gets it and who doesn't. And
what is driving it, quality or profit? If it's profit, that's against us. If it's quality, we're benefiting from it today. But unfortunately, we reached the stage where if you're normal, you will have a hard time getting tests that you really need, and you will be subjected to many tests that you don't need at all.
The problem is the federal government's made it more complicated. You know, there's some really good parts. I think it needs an overhaul.
I mean, I do think the answer, like every other Western's like democracy right now, they have affordable single-payer health care.
Well, I think everybody should have access to health care, but I am against them getting what I'm getting because I work for it.
Right now, I think we just have to let it play out and get people get used to having healthcare as a fundamental right, and then maybe we can chip away at it in the future and make people really feel it's a fundamental right and pressure their own congressmen to make it that.
You know, young, old, poor, rich, doesn't matter. I mean, what else is the government for?
We're back live with two extraordinary innovators in different sectors of the medical reform business. They're both internal medicine specialists and primary care doctors, John Goodson and Rushika Fernandopoulet. You shake your head, John, with what the person on the street is dealing with here.
Well, it's wonderful to hear people endorse the concepts behind the Affordable Care Act. I mean, what we did in the Commonwealth in 2006 was really pretty phenomenal. And what the Affordable Care Act enacted in 2010 is also phenomenal. Just remember, if you will, the world before this, where you were excluded from the healthcare system, even though you might be a taxpayer, because of your economic status. If you were really poor, you got in. And if you were middle class or had a job that had insurance, you got in. But I can tell you stories of people who literally walked up to the front door of the Mass General Hospital and turned away because they were ashamed to go into the facility without the ability to pay for health care. This is just unconscionable. It is beyond horrible. So we are now in the process of trying to realize this particular dimension of our social contract. I mean, this country does have a social fabric. We do have a commitment to one another. There is something, there's a higher goal here. Now, we need to figure out how to do this and do this in a way that's affordable, that doesn't upset and destroy this crazy, weird health economy. Health economy is basically a jobs program. But the problem is it's spun off the tracks because people have exploited too many of its particular vulnerabilities. It's like a cookie jar with lots of hands, some big hands and some little hands. We need to change the size of the reach for some of the people that are reaching into the cookie jar and taking too much.
But let me pick up on one of the men on the street there who said, you know, the civilized world knows how to do this, and somehow the United States has missed the universal boat on inclusive care for everybody at a regulated cost. Are we catching up? Are we still moving toward what in other places, Europe for starters, seems obvious?
Well, I would say it's an asymptotic process, which is to say that it's going to take some time to get there, but we need to have some fundamental commitments. We need to hold true to the course. And we have to be honest with ourselves that we've created a system that's just ripe for exploitation. And so somehow, some way, we have to roll back some of the extraordinarily excessive waste, the profit waste and the unnecessary utilization of service waste. But we can't do this from the top down. The people who are the users and the consumers of healthcare have to become much more engaged in the process of how we deliver and organize our healthcare.
Let me put it to Dr. Fernando Pillay, but it's a related question. The whole discussion, including Steve Brill's wonderful book, is just full of inhibitions about what can be said, euphemisms. You can't go after the insurance industry, for example. You just can't do it. Well, why not? Will we ever resolve on a merit, on a rational argument, the choice between public, you know, government insurance, Medicare, or whatever, it seems to be worked perfectly well in my limited experience, and the also called single payer, and this huge and incredibly powerful private insurance industry?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I've almost given up on being able to solve this problem politically. I actually think that the interests of the people you mentioned are probably too strong in this day and age for us to be able to overcome at the political level. I'm putting my bet.
But we don't say that even about other difficult problems like, well, you can't challenge the fossil fuel industry, you know, even if the world burns up. No, if the world is going to burn up, you're going to curb them. And, why do we back off on the medical interests? Yeah, is my question.
Yeah, I mean, I think the medical interests clothe themselves in this, we're the good guys, you know, and they can do that, and that's partly true, but they often don't act in what it would often be the public's best interest, right? All companies don't have a very big cloak to hide under, but I think these medical folks do.
John Goodson.
So first of all, we should recognize that the Affordable Care Act significantly changed the insurance industry because it required a set loss ratio. And remember, loss ratio is the weird world the insurance industry describes how much money they actually spend on health insurance. So prior to the Affordable Care Act, there were some companies that were only spending 70 cents on the dollar on health care. So that's now limited to 85 cents on the dollar. So that's a first step. Second thing, Medicare is not a government-run insurance agency. It's all farmed out to private vendors. The people that run Medicare are the same companies that give you United Health and Blue Cross and Blue Shield. It's a fallacy to think that Medicare is run by the government. It's administrated and monitored by the government, but it's still run by private industry. Third is that this process requires the same thing that the democracy requires for virtually everything else, which is transparency and accountability. These are the fundamental principles of the way we run things. And so if we achieve greater transparency and greater accountability, well, the problem is that the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the device industry has, as Rashika says, created a nice cloak of invulnerability. Some of that has to do with their own direct-to-consumer marketing. Some of it has to do with the mythology that surrounds these companies. And some of it, frankly, has to do with their contribution. And I'm going to say this in a positive way, to the nation's economy and to the world. If you talk to a CEO of a European pharmaceutical company, they will tell you that the R&D that they use to market and develop drugs in Europe goes on in the United States of America. This country is the R&D driver for the entire world's pharmaceutical industry. We don't capitalize on that. We subsidize it. But it's part of our economy. It's part of what keeps that particular part of our economy way ahead of everybody else. If you look at the biotechnology industry in East Cambridge, it's probably $40 to $100 billion of technology, of industry right there. Not in Switzerland. They moved to the States. So we have to figure out how to find the right set point. But I think it goes back to what I said, Christopher. It's accountability and it's responsibility, but there is a right, there's a responsibility on the part of the press, to be vigilant and to watch, and the part of consumers to ask important questions, and the part of politicians to listen to the press and listen to the consumers and step up to the plate and do their job.
Let me ask another question then, with that invitation. Why is the problem of fee-for-service charge, these endless printouts of innumerable items that you are paying for, most of them overpriced, but all considered individually, why has that not been untied by now? And what do we have to do to break it? Dr. Fernando Poulet.
Yes, we do. So we simply, when we go to payers, tell them we don't take fee for service. It is the wrong way to be paid. We will only get paid if you give us a flat fee and basically reward us more than people
say. A flat fee for the
per patient.
For the care of a patient for a year.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
And let's make it where we get rewarded if we keep people healthy as opposed to getting rewarded for keeping them sick. And we simply insist that. I imagine if the Mass General could probably do that, if the Mass General and other providers simply said, this is how we want to get paid. And I think part of the problem
and
is—
why don't they?
So this is where I'm going to disagree with Rashika, because honestly, any system that capitates runs a real risk for cherry-picking or discrimination. So I don't want to create a walled community, a gated community for healthcare. I believe that healthcare ought to be universally accessible. I believe that that anyone should be able to get excellence in healthcare. So if you look at the problem with capitation, if you look at what happened in the UK when they capitated, there was cherry picking. Patients were lost.
Probably because everybody hears capitation and they think decapitation, John. They think something ugly is happening here.
Yeah, so that means that you're paying per person. So you have a group of people and you do some risk adjustment and then you give a group of doctors or an enterprise or whatever X dollars. But, you know, there are patients out there who have high need. Those are the people that get lost in that particular model, and that is wrong. I believe the one thing I'll say to Christopher and to your audience, the fee-for-service system still gives the individual a certain power in the crazy economy of medicine. When you go to see a doctor, you are cashing in a chit. It may be paid by somebody else, but you've paid it ultimately.
We go to restaurants with that spirit, and we order a la carte. But on the other hand, what we're really longing for is for the chef to say, I've got something great for you. I want to feed you tonight.
I would not do that personally. I think that part of that choice issue, Christopher, and this is important, and this is the part of what animated the discussion about managed care 15 years ago, is the consumers led the charge and said, wait a second, you can't take away our choice. And so that was the end of managed care. Well, now we're reconfiguring managed care in some odd sort of way, and people are not quite seeing exactly what may be happening around them.
Listen, in the time we have left, I want you both to sing hymns to primary care. The joys of practicing it, the benefits for us patients, but also maybe, if you believe it, the salvation of an overpriced verging, you know, for the cliff kind of overall system. What's so great, as we were not allowed to say as kids, what's so great about primary care, Dr. Fernando Poulet?
Yeah, let me tell a quick story.
Please.
Right? Because I think we keep focusing a lot on what is it that actually heals people. So I had a patient I saw, I used to run a practice in Atlantic City, the one I wrote about, and a patient came in to me and she was out of control. She, her diabetes was under control, her hypertension was out of control, not going to the doctor and not taking her medicine. And I met her, and I got to talk to her, and we gave her a team and a health coach. And, you know, 6 months later, I ended up having to leave the practice, and I came back 6 months later. Hmm. And the doctor who had taken over said, remember that lady we met who was out of control, a hot mess, we called her? She's back. You should see her. So I went to the room, and she looked like a new person. Hair was combed, her makeup was on, her blood pressure under control, diabetes under control. She had this glint in her eyes. It's a different look when people are engaged. Hadn't been to the emergency room. And I said, Joyce, which was her name, like, what has actually made you better? And it wasn't payment models. It wasn't incentives. It wasn't fancy computers. She's really very simple. Is this doc and this health coach cared about me? They taught me to care about myself. Mm. And I didn't want to let any of us down, right? At root, healthcare is about relationships. If we can get those right, and I think primary care is the right place to start, we actually make a difference.
John Goodson.
So, you know, what has become one of the major stabilizers are these relationships in healthcare. And, you know, religion no longer serves this role. I believe that the relationships that we as primary care physicians are able to develop with patients over time becomes part of the kind of cultural stabilization. Mm. You know, I teach residents every day. I taught three residents today. And the ability to be with these guys and to encourage their development and to celebrate the relationships that they are now evolving with their patients through conversations are wonderful. But I will also say this, Christopher. The beauty of the science of medicine is unbelievable. The things I have in my workshop are off the charts. You know, I think of my grandfather. He had like a country store to choose from. My father had a small pharmacy to choose from. I've got a warehouse of cool things I can deploy for the care of patients. Mm. This is the part that I enjoy. I enjoy being the connector between the individual and this marvelous system that we've concocted here, because I see the profound benefit. I see it in the relationships that devolve. I see it in the healing, in the health that comes from all this. It is a joy. I would do this for nothing because I enjoy it so much. Mm. This is my oxygen. I breathe this stuff. It is, to me, the finest job in the world. I could not ask for anything else. And if I can impart that enthusiasm to a student, to a resident, to a fellow physician, to a colleague, and let them carry that back to their relationships with their patient, then I've been successful as a doctor and a teacher.
Last question, and thank you for that, John, but last question. I asked John McDonough, who worked for Ted Kennedy on healthcare this week, I said, what is Ted Kennedy in healthcare heaven now? What is he thinking about this? Remember, he was always to the left of the Democrats on health care. Obama, according to Sebril, is to the right of Romney care and Nixon care as of the 70s. But the question is, why? I said, what is Ted Kennedy thinking? And he said, are you kidding, Chris? He's out of his mind happy with what's been done and where it's going to go. Explain that.
So, you know, a classic Kennedy expression is don't let the perfection be the enemy of the good. Second, it's all about the sausage. You know, the fact that we have crossed that great divide, that we have a significant national commitment to resolving the inequities that plagued our healthcare system and that have been unsolvable since Teddy Roosevelt. This conversation began 100 years ago. So now we're in the process of figuring out how to do this. I think Rashika would agree, that the fundamental precepts of primary care and health care, it should be at the very core of the solution. We're at the wrong place right now. We have to figure out a way to get back to where we want to be, where we should be.
Do you agree, Dr. Fernando Poulet?
I feel like we've turned the corner. I've been doing this work for well over a dozen years. I think over the last three or four, partly due to Obamacare, but partly due to other forces, I see things getting better. I think there's more of an opportunity for folks like us to try and rebuild the system. I think there are more and more folks, and I think tomorrow will be better than today.
Thank you both, Dr. Rashika Fernando Poulet and Dr. John Goodson, both within hailing distance from the Massachusetts General Hospital. Thanks also to Steve Brill, the author. Please visit our website, share your own healthcare hack. And speaking of our website, while you're there, please join in our Kickstarter campaign as we start our second year on WBUR. We're asking you to play a part. We are an independent, nonprofit outfit with big plans for this year of 2015, and we depend on the generosity of our radio and podcast listeners to make it all happen. So
So please sign on at radioopensource.org to give us a kick. Our show this week was produced by the radio residents Max Larkin and Connor Gillies. George Hicks is our audio surgeon. Mary McGrath is our primary care doc. I am Christopher Lydon, operating without a license. Join us next time on Open Source.